The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Taxes Show. It's the show that helps you make sense of things that would otherwise baffle you. Like, for example, why does that one shoe hide in the back of the closet like that?
Is it afraid of you, or does it just need some alone time?
Or maybe it's ashamed of something. Something terrible that only a shoe would be ashamed of.
The answers to these and other questions right here, right now on the Eric Metaxas Show.
And now your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm Eric Metaxas. This is the show. This is it. I can't do any better than this, but here's what I can do. I can get amazing guests like show business legends who still look too young to be legends. That's my goal. And right now I have someone I think of now as a friend, Mr. Pat Boone. Mr. Pat Boone, welcome, and stop doing whatever it is you're doing with that mask. It's okay. It's okay.
We don't have to socially distance that.
No. COVID was a hoax. It's okay. We can just let it go now.
Oh,
just say you're protesting.
You're okay?
Just say you're protesting, and they'll let it go. Seriously.
Yeah, I am a protester.
You're in California. I'm in New York City. If we just say we're protesting, they'll let it go. Don't worry about it. Pat Boone, welcome. It's a joy to see your face. And it's embarrassing to me that I look more clean cut than you. You're supposed to be the most clean cut man on the planet. But you look relaxed in California.
You cut yourself? Yeah, I am clean cut, clean cut,
Well, look, people are certainly not here to hear me yammer on. They want to hear from you. So let me at least ask you a question. We're living in divided times, Pat. And one of the joys of speaking to somebody who's been around as long as you have is you remember the Vietnam era and how divided the country was. What do you say to folks who are looking for a little hope right now amidst the division?
Well, I guess the best thing we can possibly say is that we did come through it. There was a lot of healing. There was a lot of progress. Like they often say when bad things happen, well, maybe it'll work out to be for your good. One thing the Bible says that God works everything together for our good. For those of us who love him and are called according to his purpose. So even when bad things happen, we can benefit from them if we learn from them. But what's so different about this situation is we've been through riots. We've been through protests. We've been through these things where folks who were not even legitimate protesters filtered into the real protesters and became marauders and robbers and thugs and criminals. And we know that's happened, and the media doesn't want to deal with it. But I think the general public knows that legitimate protesters don't come to a protest with a Molotov cocktail, with a stone.
Are you sure about that?
Well, not legitimate protesters. Yes, no. And they don't come with guns.
No.
They don't come with guns.
You know I'm joking. What you're saying, of course, is true. And that's what's so difficult right now. There's a darkness that we didn't have in the 60s. There was a kind of an innocence to those protests and to things, and something has happened now where we have the wheat and tares growing together, and it's very tough for some people to see that. And I think you're right. The people in the media kind of don't want to see it, or they don't want to report on it. That was not true 50 years ago.
Well, what's going to come out now, of course, in the trial, and I don't know how the media is going to handle this.
Trial?
Protesters, but the trial of the policeman, because that's, of course, he's going to be tried for murder too, and the other police as well, because it was an inexcusable thing that happened. But what's going to come out in the trial all the details that the media has not wanted to deal with, which includes the fact that the policeman and George Floyd knew each other already. They'd already had some fracas. There was dissension between the two of them personally, and that Floyd has a serious criminal record, which involves a lot of, he was in prison 7 times, I think. No, nobody wants to talk about that. The media doesn't want to deal with it, but because they've insisted, of course, on the trials of the police, all of this is going to come out because it'll be a matter of their defense attorneys trying to explain some of the background of what went on there and why that happened. Not that it excuses it, but there's been a sugarcoating of the whole thing because it suits the purposes of those who are really trying to turn the U.S. into a socialistic country where the government provides everything for everybody. And then, of course,
I agree with you, Pat. The only one who has really come out and said some of what you just were referencing is Candace Owens. She had the bravery, as she always seems to do, to say the things that no one else will say. Because as you said, it certainly doesn't excuse anything, but let's dare to look at all the facts like adults. I want to talk to you about the deeper divisions, though, that have existed for a long time when it comes to particularly Christians. You have been very vocal about your faith from the beginning, from a time when it was culturally acceptable into the time when it became less acceptable and then unacceptable. And I want to talk, for example, about the fact that you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm asking you, so you're not bragging on yourself, but let's talk about just the objective facts of your recording industry successes. And because the fact that you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it is absolutely bizarre. It's like, you know, Babe Ruth not being in the Baseball Hall of Fame. What did we miss? Why is he not there? And since I'm bringing it up, do me and my audience a favor of talking about that.
I'll be happy to. And I'm not bragging because, A, I didn't accomplish it all on purpose. It happened to me. And whenever a song was put in front of me that I liked, I would record it. I didn't choose the songs in my early career. Randy Wood of Dot Records was the genius who, like some of the other early recording executives, discovered that rhythm and blues, which was a separate genre of music, it was called race music. People don't remember that rhythm and blues, there was no rock and roll as such. It was rhythm and blues, which was race music, black music. There was pop music, songs being created on Tin Pan Alley and by professional pop songwriters. And, you know, how much is that Doggy in the Window and Tennessee Waltz? And, you know, great, great songs of our past. And all of a sudden, there were these rhythm and blues songs that were being heard. And the producers were having pop artists do these songs. Well, I happened to come along. I say happened. At that one cusp in music history where I was first asked to record rhythm and blues hits, which were not known to the huge pop audience and were not going to be because race music was not played on pop radio. So my first record was Two Hearts, Two Kisses, a R&B hit by The Charms on the Dutone label, long since passed away. And I had a million seller record, my very first record. The second record was a Fats Domino song called Ain't That a Shame on his label. And he sold 150,000 number one R&B hit, but it was not played on pop radio. And nobody in pop music, including the DJs, knew who Fats Domino was. That was my second record, was a cover of Ain't That a Shame. You made me cry when you said goodbye, ain't that a shame?
My tears fell like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. You broke my heart when you
said, we'll part, ain't that a shame? My tears fell like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. Farewell, goodbye. Although I'll cry, ain't that a shame? My tears fell like rain.
On a day like today, we pass the time.
You know that we all know Ain't That a Shame, but the first one you mentioned, yeah, your first hit, how does the lyric, how does the melody go to the first hit?
One heart's not enough, baby. Two hearts will make you feel crazy. One kiss will make you feel so nice. Two kisses take you to paradise. Two hearts, two kisses make one love. Frank Sinatra recorded that song at the same time I did. Doris Day recorded it. The Lancers, the DeCastro sisters, everybody, pop, a lot of pop artists jumped on that song. The reason mine was a hit is that I captured more of the original flavor of that song. Frank Sinatra didn't sound like a rock and roller, nor did he want to sound like it. He hated it. And yet he recorded the song because the A&R people wanted him to.
You mean that the whitest man on the whitest man on the planet, Pat Boone, is way blacker than Frank Sinatra? Is that what you're telling me? Because it sounds like that's what happened.
Listen, I went into radio stations, Eric, when my record of Two Hearts, Two Kisses was just hitting the charts, and it was really booming up the charts. And the promotion guy would take me into a radio station and say, I've got that kid, Pat Boone, that's got that record of Two Hearts, Two Kisses. And the DJ or the program director would look out in the lobby, that's not Pat Boone. What? Pat Boone's black. No, that's Pat Boone. And so I would have to come in and show him my identification bracelet prove this white kid from Nashville really was the guy singing Two Hearts, Two Kisses. Because what I did just now with you didn't sound as hard rock as my record was. But I was complimented. 1955. Not only was I complimented that they thought I was black, but I was on the rhythm and blues charts. I was on the race music charts with about my first five or six records. Ain't That a Shame, Two Hearts, Two Kisses, I'll Be Home, which was a hit by the Flamingos, Crazy Little Mama Come Knock, Knock, Knocking, Knocking at My Front Door, Door, Door. These were all rhythm and blues songs. And I was on the rhythm and blues charts because I was considered a rhythm and blues artist. And I came on and started singing their songs. They couldn't believe I was a white guy because they thought, surely this kid is one of us. Well, I took that as a tremendous compliment because I was capturing enough of the feeling, the flavor. I wasn't going to imitate Little Richard on Tutti Frutti or sound like Fats Domino. I was doing the songs my way, but with a lot of the same general instrumental flavor and feeling and excitement. And I was really into it. I was loving it. And so I was widely accepted. Jesse Jackson, I don't know if I told you this, recently, 3 or 4 years ago, did an album of R&B classics with the original performers. I did Papa's Got a Brand New Bag with James Brown. Hey, Pat's got a brand new bag. And I did Way of the World with Earth, Wind, and Fire, Tears of a Clown with Smokey Robinson, Can't Help Myself with the Four Tops, and on, Celebration with Kool and the Gang. And
what?
Woman Needs
Man. Pat, hold on.
Yes,
a second.
I did it.
Are you sure? Be honest, because this is are you sure you're not black?
Well, I'm doing my best, as you can see. I'm trying my best.
I got to tell you, you really. But I mean, a lot of this stuff, a lot of younger people just don't know your history. Let me ask you a couple of quick questions just to give us some context for folks who don't know you. How did you get into the music business? In other words, when you were a teenager, when you were 15, did you think you might become a recording artist?
No, of course I dreamed of it. And I don't think I actually verbally prayed, but I used to milk our family cow until I was... Well, until Shirley and I married at 19, really. I was living at home, And my brother and I took turns milking our family cow. We lived in about 10 acres. My dad, a building contractor, four kids, and we had a vegetable garden, and we had sometimes pigs and chickens and rabbits, and we milked the cow because I would drink as much as a gallon of milk a day. My brother did too, quart at breakfast, quart at lunch, quart at dinner, and then studying homework, maybe some more. I mean, I was a milk-fed, milk-raised kid. So I'd be milking Rosemary. It didn't take much brain power. And I'm thinking, boy, if I was on the Arthur Godfrey show, which was huge on TV and radio back then, with a young singer named Julius LaRosa, if I were
Julius
on a show
LaRosa,
like that.
I only know Julius LaRosa because he used to appear on the Jerry Lewis telethon here in New York. This is in the 70s, but I don't know what he was. But I'm saying my generation doesn't really know him. But okay, so
he'd been in the Navy. Arthur discovered him when they did a show on a Navy ship. And this Julius LaRosa sang well. He brought him on and became hey, compadre, tu vas sonare. He had some big Italian sounding pop records. And so I thought, wow, I'm milking the cow thinking, boy, if I was on Arthur Godfrey show, I could go to school in the morning. I dreamed of going to an Ivy League school. And I could, in the afternoons, I could do things maybe for medicine as a singer that raised money like Danny Kaye, Bing Crosby, Bob Hope for medicine and do things for school, for colleges. And even in the spiritual things like my preacher role models, if I had that kind of platform, and I'm just milking that cow, and I'm telling you, from about less than 3 years after I was sitting there milking Rosemary, I married, moved to Texas, wound up making my first record, and I replaced Julius LaRosa on the Arthur Godfrey show. In about 3 years, he got fired off the show because he was taking Arthur for granted and just showing up when he felt like it because his career was booming. And so he had me come in and I replaced Julius LaRosa on his show. Now, I went from milking the cow thinking about this, not dreaming it would ever happen, but wishful thinking and not exactly praying, but saying, almost, Lord, if you gave me that opportunity, I would try to make it count for good things.
Well, how did that work? In other words, how do you go from milking Rosemary to, you know, the Arthur Godfrey show? In other words, at what point do you break in to singing publicly on any level where you could be discovered by Arthur Godfrey? How did that happen?
You're a man of excellent questions. During that time, while I was still home in college, dating the woman I was going to marry, Shirley, my schoolmate and sweetheart, I entered a talent contest in Nashville. I had entered a number of talent contests in Nashville before because I loved to sing and I didn't expect to win. I was just a guy who could sing a pop song. And those talent shows in Nashville, which were widespread across the city and county, I would usually come in second to a opera singer, pianist, a tap dancer, a violinist, somebody who had obviously put in lots of time studying some art. And I was just a pop singer singing a pop song. So the kids in the audience, they liked what I was doing. But of course, the judges would pick that classically trained person as the winner. But this one night at East Nashville High, I entered and there was a girl named Shirley McGoy. I'll never forget. She was a classically trained operatic singer. She sang great. I sang a lame duet of two songs. I couldn't decide whether to sing a up-tempo song or a dramatic ballad. So I put them together. We ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel along singing a song side by side. I believe for every drop of rain that falls. The two songs have nothing to do with each other, but it gave me a chance.
So you wanted to do a medley to show your range.
Versatility, yeah. But I did not expect to win. So I asked my parents who were there at that show, as soon as I performed, I'll be toward the last of the program. I know this opera singer girl is going to win because the prize is a trip to New York and an audition with Ted Mack, the big American Idol forerunner show. and just an audition, but I didn't expect to win. I never did. So I said, I'll meet you at the car in the parking lot and we can beat the traffic going home. So I was out at the car. I had already performed. And somebody comes to the back door of the high school gymnasium, East Nashville High. Pat Boone, where are you? And I said, I'm over here by the car. Come in, you're winning. You've won. What? And I came in and I went past Shirley McGoy, who was weeping in the wings. She thought she was going to win. And I thought she was going to win. Thought she should. So the audience was tired of applauding, wondering where in the world I was. So I thanked everybody. I said, you know, I appreciate you're selecting me, but I really think Shirley McGoy ought to go to New York because she has a better chance of getting on the Ted Mack show than I do. They said, no, you're a winner. You've got to go. So I did. And I got on and it was viewer voting. It was cards and letters. I went on a Saturday night and I had to wait till Thursday to know if I was the winner. I won 3 weeks in a row. But now before I could ever compete with other three-time winners, nobody knew when that was going to happen. Shirley and I married. I moved to North Texas State in Denton, Texas. On my way
another Shirley. The other Shirley. This is a moment we're going to have to go to a break. Pat, hold that thought. We'll be right back. Folks, I know you won't go away. Stick around.
Two kisses make one love.
The Trump campaign has a special offer just for you. President Trump wants to meet you. This will be the first opportunity he's had to meet with American patriots like you since our country started reopening. His team will cover the flight and hotel and give you VIP access for yourself and a guest. He'll even take a picture with you. All you have to do is text VIP to 88022 today for your chance to meet President Trump. Again, that's VIP to 88022 for your chance to win and join President Trump in the fight to keep America great for four more years.
April love is for the very young. Every star's a wishing star that shines for you.
Hey there, folks. The Eric Metaxas Show. I'm introducing you to a new young kid. He's a fresh talent. You may not have heard of him before, but you will hear of him in the future. I think he's got a real career ahead of him, Mr. Pat Boone. Pat Boone, welcome.
That sounds familiar. I heard that a few times in the early days of my career.
Well, can you imagine how true that is? Listen, if that opera singer who was named Shirley, not your wife, Shirley, but if that opera singer had won that contest at East Nashville High School, I'd be talking to that opera singer right now. And where would you be? I don't know. I want to ask you.
I'd be teaching.
I still understand the idea that, okay, there used to be talent contests in those days, but how did you even get to the point where you enter a talent contest? Did you sing at home? Did you have an ambition? That's what I want to know. When you were, 17 years old, whatever it was, did you have an ambition where you would go and sing? Did you sing at weddings? Did you do anything like that? Where did you sing? Did you just sing in your bedroom? How'd it go?
All of that. I was known as that kid out on Lone Oak Road who knew all the current pop tunes. From the time I was about 14, 15 years old, I had learned that I could sing and I could sing those pop songs. And if there was ever any excuse in a school play or a musical or anything, the teacher would call on me and I would be happy to do it, or I'd volunteer. And then I was known that, I was singing ladies. Yeah, around town.
That's all I need to know. I'll tell you why, because I want to get back to my original question, which you dodged. I noticed that. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Do my audience a favor and tell us, you know, how many hits you had and all that kind of business, because I want people to understand when it comes to the record industry, what your name and what your songs and what your recordings mean. Do me that favor and forgive me for asking that question.
No, I'm glad you. So in the last half of the 50s, from 55 through 59, I had 41 chart records. Elvis had 40. He came along. He and I met when he was my opening act in Cleveland the first time we met. He was not known yet. He was appearing on the Louisiana Hayride in Shreveport, Louisiana. And my third record of At My Front Door in March, no, now in October of 55, was climbing the charts and on its way to being a million seller, my third record. And I did a sock hop in Cleveland, October 22nd of 55. And this kid was brought up from Shreveport, where he was appearing on the Louisiana Hayride on a weekly show and was known as a rockabilly singer. And he came in backstage. He was going to be on the same sock hop that I was on in Cleveland for the nation's number one DJ. And I said, "Hi, Elvis, I'm Papin. Nice to meet you." I said, he had a couple of his buddies with him. And I said, "Well, Bill Randall seems to think some nice things are maybe ahead for you. Just been signed by RCA Victor." "Well, I don't know, but I hope so." And he just leaned back against the wall and his buddies closed in around him. And he seemed so shy. I thought, "Uh-oh, this guy's scared. He may flub up out here when in front of this big crowd of 3,000 kids." But he came out and we lip synced our records. That's what you do at a sock hop. So he lip synced a Bill Monroe country song called Blue Moon of Kentucky. I mean, it was his record of it, but a country song. And I could see the kids looking through the curtain at the kids. I could see they were talking. "He's cute, isn't he? Boy, yeah, but he looks like the kid we're not supposed to be. A mother wouldn't want us to be hanging out with him. He looks like that rebel right at school." And but they didn't like his music. So when he finished that first song, he said, "Thank you very much. I'd like to do this side of that record for you. Hope you like it." And he did, "That's all right, mama. That's all right with me." And the kids loved that. It was rhythm and blues. And they wanted more, but that's all he had. So he left. I came out. I had three big million-selling hits. So I got all the screams that night. And I had the good sense never to follow him again on a show.
That is amazing. But I mean, come on. The fact that Elvis Presley, let's just put the fact here. Elvis Presley was your opening act. I don't think there are many people that can say that. I don't believe that I could say that, for example. Okay. And I think most of my viewers could not say that. So that's pretty significant. Elvis was your opening act. But look, there's some people who they can say stuff like that, but they didn't go on to much. You kept going and going and going. So when you just stack up how many hits you had that were chart hits, you said you had 41 in the 50s alone?
In the 50s and another 23 in the 60s, all but any other artist except the Beatles in the 60s. And then I've kept going, of course, for this is my 65th year, I think, of recording. I'm still recording. I'm up to 2,300 separate songs that I've recorded, all many genres, country, pop, rock and roll. I wanted you to know about this. I'm the only artist in all of these years to do all of America's great patriotic songs, including the national anthem, America the Beautiful, My Country 'Tis of Thee, There's a Star-Spangled Banner Waving Somewhere, because Eminem never thought about it, Poop Daddy never did. None of the artists, or whatever he calls himself now, P. Diddy.
Eminem and Poop Daddy?
Yeah, never.
Eminem is a chocolate candy, and Poop Daddy doesn't exist. But most people know what you mean. So you know what, Pat?
Yeah.
Lucky for both of us, we're going to go to a break right now. Folks, when we come back, I'm not kidding, I'm going to be sitting here talking to the legendary Pat Boone. Don't go away.
Moody River, more deadly than the Venus knife. Moody River, your body.
Hey, folks, welcome back. I'm talking to Pat Boone, the Pat Boone. And here's what's fascinating. He's a legend. You probably know more about him than I do. But I'll tell you what, he keeps dodging my question. I'm trying to get to the meat of why he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he's too humble to share the details with us. But we're not going to let it go. Pat, we want you to help us understand, because it really does make no sense. And I think it's because, you know, you're a wholesome, conservative Christian man. You have been your whole life. How can you explain with all of the hits that you've had, and that you were not just that, but that you were a pioneer in the genre. You were a pioneer in the genre. If anybody ought to be there, I mean, if they're going to put Little Richard there, it seems to me you ought to be there.
Well, I agree with you, because just on the basis of sheer numbers in the charts, not just on the pop charts and rock and roll chart, but in the rhythm and blues charts.
We just lost your sound.
Uh-oh.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Lost my sound?
No, you're fine.
Okay.
You're fine. You're good.
I told you about the album, my R&B Classics album, and I was promoting that on the Rainbow Coalition radio station, Chicago, owned by the Rainbow Coalition, with Santita Jackson. And we were talking about my recording with James Brown, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Smokey Robinson, the Four Tops, and that they were R&B giants who were recording new versions of their hits with me, which they would never have done if they had the impression as R&B greats. That when I did my covers of Tutti Frutti, Wrong Tall Sally, Rip It Up, Ain't That a Shame, all these songs, if I was taking something from black artists instead of enhancing their careers, that they wouldn't have recorded with me. But they all happily did that. Now, I was promoting the album, and Santita asked the engineer while we were talking, is that on the phone who I think it is? Put him on. It was her dad, Jesse Jackson. He said, I'm going to make a statement. He said, we came to love Pat Boone in Chicago through his father-in-law, Red Foley, who sang he was in the Country Hall of Fame, and he sang our Negro spirituals, Peace in the Valley and Close to Walker Thee. But his son-in-law came along, and a white kid from Nashville was singing our rhythm and blues songs.
And wait a minute, your father-in-law was a singer? Your father-in-law was a singer?
Red Foley. Oh, yeah,
Red Foley. I didn't know
Shirley's
that.
Dad. And he's in the rock and the rhythm, country music Hall of Fame. But Jesse Jackson says, I want to make a statement that I've never made publicly. I think Pat Boone did more for race relations through his music than any other artist, because he was a white kid doing what was called race music, black music, and making it popular on widely, spread pop music stations. Not only that, but loving the other performers and having them come on his TV show, Little Richard and Fats and all these other artists.
Do you
artists.
Understand what you just said? Okay, very interesting, because most of the people who got super famous and super rich, like, for example, the Rolling Stones, many blacks have hated and resented them because they felt that they did steal from them and not give back. So I find it very interesting that you were not perceived that way. Do you know that Chuck Berry punched Keith Richards in the face when he first met him? Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. Well, Chuck Berry did not like Keith Richards because he saw them as having stolen his stuff. In other words, he didn't make a tenth of the money that the Rolling Stones made. So I just find this very interesting that the black artists of that day recognized you as someone bringing recognition to them and really giving back. That's really something I had not known. That's very interesting.
Let me quote one of the original artists, one who just recently passed, my friend Little Richard. When I recorded Tutti Frutti, his record had just come out and was becoming an R&B hit, but as I say, pop radio knew nothing about it. I recorded Tutti Frutti, and then later, of course, mine became a million seller. And then I did Rip It Up and Long Tall Sally. Well, as his career began to take off, because he became known then to the pop artists, to the pop DJs as well. And he was asked on a black station, and I have the tape of it, in which he and Bumps Blackwell, his producer, were being interviewed. And the interviewer said, how did you feel when you heard Pat Boone had done your song Tutti Frutti? And Little Richard says, I was still washing dishes in a bus station in Macon, Georgia. My record was getting played on the radio, but I wasn't making no money now. He says, but when I heard Pat Boone had done my song, I threw the towel down and walked out of there because I was going to make some money now. And that was his position back then. If some white artist did a black artist's song, it was going to popularize it to an audience they couldn't reach. And then they would follow those hits and become big stars themselves.
And Little Richard certainly became a big star. That's right. And of course, he just passed. You knew him by his real name. What was Little Richard's actual name?
Richard Pennyman.
Pennyman. Yeah.
Richard
Pennyman. Not to be confused with George Pennyman Groucho Show. Right.
That was Pennyman, but he was Pennyman.
George Pennyman was George Groucho. Fenneman. Okay, listen, we just got a minute left here in this segment, but is it crazy for me to suggest that logic would dictate that you ought to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And I'm talking by a long shot. There are people that are in there and bands that are in there that I laugh at the idea that they're in there and that you're
not. Yeah, I mean, some had only one or two hits. You don't even know who they are. That little team of, they select the ones they just happen to like, and there's some who never were really rock and roll. Billy Joel was never rock and roll. Paul Simon was never rock and roll. They were legitimate jazz pop, incredible writers. And there were beats to some of their songs, but they weren't in the same category as Little Richard and Fats Domino. And so, yes, I do belong there. In fact, I think Elvis and I, because he did the same thing I did. We both recorded Good Rockin' Tonight and Boost Weight Shoes and some of those other songs. We covered other artists doing their hits, which we all did. But the two of us, I think, were midwives at the birth of rock and roll, because we helped usher into the pop world songs and music and artists that were not known that time.
No question about it. Forgive me, Pat. We're going to go to another break. Forgive me. We have one final segment coming up, and we're going to sing How Much Is That Doggy in the Window. We'll be right back.
You better get ready, because I'm telling you why. The Lord is a-coming from his throne on high. Going down the valley, going one by one. We're going to be rewarded for the things we've done.
Don't forbid me hold you tight, darling, don't forbid me to hold you tight.
Folks, welcome back. Just a couple of more minutes with Pat Boone. Pat, you've sung every genre, including, unfortunately, heavy metal. We're not going to talk about that, but I want to talk to you about your hymn singing. Let's talk about, you sung an awful lot of hymns. Elvis did too. Tell us about your hymn singing.
Well, I was singing, you know, that's how I came along. That's how I developed my singing voice, as so many black artists did. They became singers in the black churches and sang gospel music. Aretha Franklin classically, but so many of the others, almost without exception. And so that was true of me as a white kid in Nashville, leading singing in all of our gospel meetings and church services. A cappella, because we didn't have piano or organ. It was all non-instrumental. And so I had, as a kid, to lead congregations of 300, 400, 500 people, maybe with no microphone, sing the wondrous love of Jesus. I was waving my hand like I knew what that meant, but it was just vocally. So it was great vocal exercise. Now, my career takes off. I'm singing rock and roll. I'm singing movie themes. And I thought, boy, if the teenage kids will buy anything I record, and they would, I knew at that point, I'm going to do an album of hymns. So in the 50s, in the midst of all the rock and roll, while I was having 41 chart records with pop and rock and roll songs, I did the first million-selling hymn album with songs that we all sang at church. And, of course, the kids gobbled it up. It was the first million-selling hymn album. And
so you are using your fame for God's purposes. I just want to be the one to say that. In other words, you took what God gave you, this tremendous platform, and you said, I'm going to bring the songs of Jesus and God to these young people who may not have known them. That's wonderful. Right. And it's one, yet another reason to love you. I think that, you know, it's so interesting because you don't really see people doing that today. Being a person of faith has kind of gone out of favor in the culture in a way that, as you know, that's a big part of my, you know, that's my bugbear, my bete noire. I really think that we need to bring faith back to the mainstream of culture. And I love the fact that you did that. That's just extraordinary to me.
But it is probably the signal reason that I'm not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because it did not popularize me with Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone and the ones who make the decisions, because I didn't live a rock and roll lifestyle. I sang many other types of songs, not just rock and roll. So the fact that I had many rock and roll hits and helped it become popular in pop circles of music, that doesn't count because I did
it's
not live
such
a rock
pity.
And roll lifestyle.
It's such a pity you didn't go through a heroin phase, you know, just a brief strung out heroin phase, because I think you'd be in that museum today if you'd done that. If only you had flirted with heroin. It's kind of a pity. Kind of a pity. Yeah.
You know, I thought the heavy metal album would do it for me, because here I was doing Smoke on the Water and Led Zeppelin songs and all these. And Ozzy Osbourne's Crazy Train, he was living next door to me then. And I went on TBN, of course, when I went on the American Music Awards presented with Alice Cooper, the award for hard rock heavy metal, and I was wearing the black leather and the tattoos on the show, I was immediately kicked off Christian TV, including TBN, because it looked like I had gone off to the dark side. And later...
We're at a time, and I'm so sorry. Look, you know I will have you back as soon as possible. I'll have you back as soon as possible. I'm sorry we only had this much time. You are a great blessing. Thank you for the gift of your time to me and to my audience. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Eric. You know I admire you, man.
I can't go, but I am sure. Of this one thing, that God is real.